Greetings, Antifada listeners. Jamie Peck here to tell you about an exciting new project that you are about to listen to in your Antifada podcast feed. I have started a new podcast called Party Girls with my friend Sam Beard.
Hi.
He is my work husband from the Block Cop City Convergence and beyond. So this podcast will cover, you know, a lot of the things that I've been interested in all along, as well as we really want to cover this movement, this which is currently coalesced around the fight over Cop City in Atlanta, but certainly has ambitions to extend beyond that. We're really going to be covering this movement from the inside of it, which I think is really exciting. So for this episode that Andy so generously offered to run in the Antifada feed, we discuss a 2018 issue of a zine called Inhabit, which comes out of the sort of ultra-left milieu. This is sort of the beginning of a reading group that we're going to have where we discuss different contemporary writings called Party Girls Reading Group, name still being workshopped. But anyway, if you like what you hear, you can sign up as a subscriber in the Party Girls feed. And if you really like it, you can give us money at patreon.com/partygirls. And we have just set up a Discord server for our paying members, and we're going to have a whole lot more cool stuff where that came from. So thanks for listening, and I hope you like it. Hello and welcome to Party Girls, the communist podcast for dumb bitches. Or maybe we're just told by society that we're dumb, but we're actually really smart. I'm Jamie Peck.
And I'm Sam Beard, and we're about to get a whole lot smarter.
Oh, are we? Are we ever? So this is the first edition of the Party Girls Reading Group. I posted a question. I made a poll on my Instagram stories the other day. Like, would you find a Party Girls Reading Group valuable, or are you just here for the thirst traps? Because, you know, my audience on Instagram is a little column A, a little column B, and there's a Venn diagram, which is surprisingly large. But yeah, for a little while, I was like, ooh, wow, these are neck and neck. But turns out that the eyes have it. And the people who said, yes, I love to read and learn, they won. So we're doing it, because that's what I base all of my professional decisions on the results of my Instagram polls.
Got to give the people what they want. And, you know, I think we're not 100% sure what form it will take. Some interactive, quasi-interactive, fully interactive, non-interactive. Not 100% sure yet, but we'll figure that out and keep it and keep circling back to that. For now, I think it's just going to be you and me for this episode. Reading, reviewing, analyzing, and talking about a zine or an essay or a contemporary-ish piece of writing once a week. Throwing it up on YouTube and on the podcast for our listeners to enjoy, maybe participate in once we build out that tech infrastructure.
That's right.
This is our first episode. And for our first episode, we are going to do the zine, the piece, the text, Inhabit, Instructions for Autonomy. So Inhabit, Instructions for Autonomy, or The Little Orange Book, is an anonymously authored text that comes out of the North American sort of like post-left insurrectionary communist current, whatever that means. It was published in 2018 and has made quite a little splash in communization, communist, and ultra-left circles around the United States and around the world. It's translated into Spanish, French, Polish, Italian, English, maybe Mandarin, maybe other languages. And it's sort of a contemporary, like, eco-revolutionary manifesto that lays out a sort of revolutionary framework or program, yes, complete with little numbered steps towards building the infrastructure necessary to not only sustain a life outside of the clutches of the state and capital, but also build out the foundations for a multi-generational material revolutionary force. And this little orange book, maintains that they have the answers. And I guess we'll find out.
That's the good shit right there. That is the communist full Monty that, you know, I think regular listeners of me, I trust them at this point to have a scaffolding of good Marxist materialism atop which this will be placed in its proper context. But, oh, a little note on post-left, the term you just threw out there. I feel like a lot of my, a lot of our peeps will be more familiar with that term as something that's applied to, like, these socially conservative, social democrat types to the degree that they have a coherent politics beyond, like, contrarianism, you know? Like, these anti-woke, quote-unquote leftists, like fucking Amy Therese and, like, I don't know, the Cumtown Orbit and Red Scare and whatnot. But that's not what we're talking about when we say post-left. It's like some, it's some anarchist ultra-left shit that's completely different.
I am very bad with my terms and with my genres, if you will. And I guess sort of what I meant by that is an abandonment of traditional leftist politics, conceptualizations of the revolutionary subject, as well as traditional leftist organizational forms and NGOs and recuperative mechanisms like that.
That's right. So just, you know, just a little note, a little FYI on that. And yeah, this is basically like the marshmallows in the Lucky Charms. If you are a communist, you know, we need some visions of the future. I think it helps break us out of capitalist realism, that thing that we're always talking about. So yeah, parts of this read like a work of speculative fiction. kind of, it actually reminds me of Everything for Everyone, the book by Emmy O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi that I actually interviewed the authors on my old podcast, Everybody Loves Communism. Everybody go back and check that out if you are interested. It was a really good interview. It was a two-parter. But yeah, Emmy is a very, is more... I don't think she necessarily identifies as a Marxist, but she has learned the most from reading Marx versus other things. And I feel similarly. And perhaps as a result of that, she was very reluctant to say that the book was anything but a work of fiction. She didn't mean it to be programmatic in any way. This issue of Inhabit is like, no, this is a program. And it's not just a program. It's a strategy. And it's not just a strategy. It's a zine. But it's more than that. like, I really love their little bio that they put in the in the George Floyd book by the Vortex Group, the book on the George Floyd uprising that I often reference, where they say, quote, Inhabit is a collectively and anonymously written strategy emerging from a network of autonomous projects across North America, which is like, whoa. That's some good hype right there, right? Mm. Like, this is not just a zine. It is a strategy. So shall we?
We shall. So Inhabit has 8 steps. Step 1, find each other. Step 2, establish hubs. Step 3, become resilient. 4, share a future. 5, bring the fight. 6, expand the network. 7, build autonomy. 8, destitute infrastructure. 9, become ungovernable. Why don't we go ahead and we'll read the first few pages or so from this little book. Without further ado. Inhabit, Instructions for Autonomy. There are two paths, the end of the world or the beginning of the next. You have to choose. The end of the world. It's over. Bow your head and phone scroll through the apocalypse. Path A. Watch as Silicon Valley replaces everything with robots. New fundamentalist death cults make ISIS look like child's play. The authorities release a geolocation app to real-time snitch on immigrants and political dissent while metafascists crowdfund the next concentration camps. Government services fail. Politicians turn to more draconian measures, and the left continues to bark without teeth. Meanwhile, glaciers melt, wildfires rage, hurricane whatever drowns another city. Ancient plagues reemerge from thawing permafrost. endless work as the rich benefit from ruin. Finally, knowing we did nothing, we perish, sharing our tomb with all life on the planet.
Yee. Yikes. So yeah, let's see if there's another option. Oh, look, the beginning of the next path. B, take a breath and get ready for a new world. A multiplicity of people, spaces, and infrastructures lay the ground where powerful autonomous territories take shape. Everything for everyone. Land is given over to common use. Technology is cracked open. Everything a tool, anything a weapon. Autonomous supply lines break the economic stranglehold. Mesh networks provide real-time communication, connecting those who sense that a different life must be built. While governments fail, the autonomous territories thrive with a new sense that to be free, we must be bound to this earth and life on it. Enclaves of techno-feudalism are plundered for their resources. We confront the dwindling forces of counter-revolution with the option to hell or utopia. Oh, that slaps so much harder than socialism or barbarism even. No shade on Rosa Luxemburg. This is like, this is another version and it's cool. Sorry, I digress. Either answer satisfies us. What? Tell me more. Finally, we reach the edge. We feel the danger of freedom, the embrace of living together, the miraculous and the unknown, and know this is life.
So you read a line, we confront the dwindling forces of counter-revolution with the option to hell or utopia. Either answer satisfies us. And what that sort of like reminded me of was, I don't know, that period in between like March 2020 and like June 2020, that was just like the strangest period in any of our lives. And it was like maybe the most exciting part of my adult, the most exciting time of my adult life. And obviously not only in good ways, right? But there was still this element of just like, I had no idea what the future was going to look like. None of us did. And that's like the first time that it didn't seem like everything was set in stone and that the future was up for grabs. And then the insurrection and the George Floyd rebellion came and everything just like exploded around the country. And that's sort of what, you know, to hell or utopia, either answer satisfies us, but we need to get off this miserable path.
So, okay, I am not satisfied with either answer. I would much rather go to utopia than hell, personally. Although, I mean, it's not going to be a utopia in actuality. Like, it feels very utopian now because it is so far away from what we know in our day-to-day lives. But, I mean, yeah, maybe we're going to get into, like, a little bit of the death drive that was driving some of the most bold, impressive, cool, whatever you want to call it, actions during the uprising in 2020 on the part of proletarians with very little to lose. So maybe that's what it's referring to. Anyway, there's a part here in this, there's a few introductory sections, and I wanted to highlight this on page 21, if you're looking in the paper version of the zine, where they say, "The revolutionary character of our epoch cannot be denied, but we've yet to overcome the hurdle between us and freedom." So this is something that we talk about a lot these days. I think it's, you know, it's hard not to notice the amount of activity, whatever you want to call it, the amount of like proto-revolutionary activity on the part of regular people all over the world, whether you're talking about the Arab Spring, whether you're talking about the uprising in Sri Lanka, where they kicked out the government, whether you're talking about the George Floyd uprising, you know, I'm going to be a little spicy and throw Hong Kong in there. That was super real as well. Maybe someday we'll do a China episode. That's like the fucking white whale for leftist podcasters. Anyway, there's been an explosion of popular resistance movements around the world. And it hasn't always fit neatly into left and right categories, you know, which is another thing they talk about here. But, you know, like Vincent Bevins talks about in that fucking book that everyone keeps referencing that I guess we should probably read at some point. It has not resulted yet certainly hasn't resulted in a better world. And, you know, the steps between these sort of popular uprisings, these sort of, the way that article in Endnotes that I like to cite calls it is like these times have produced revolutionaries without a revolution. And, you know, I think that even calling them revolutionaries and saying the revolutionary character of our epoch cannot be denied, I think that's getting out over our skis a little bit, because most of the people involved are not conscious, you know, communist revolutionaries. They're upset about a thing, generally, whether it's political rights or economic rights or some intersection thereof. I think the fact that there's a lot of missing steps there between that and communism is very, very apparent. And it's the question of the hour, the question on everyone's minds.
Yeah, it's like a lot of us have known and have said in various ways that we can't like restrict the scope of our work to insurrectionary moments of rupture. And we need to build between those ruptures, so that when those cracks inevitably do happen again, we can sort of inhabit those cracks and prevent them from closing with some sort of durable life-supporting flows. And I feel like everybody knows this. Different lineages, different historical tendencies, different contemporary projects try to answer this question in different ways. You know, you've got mutual aid as a framework. You know, the Black Panthers did, you know, maybe more building than they did fighting, or at least equal amounts of both, you know, so much life supporting infrastructure in their neighborhoods that they operated within. And Inhabit tries to answer it the same sort of way. And it's like, I sort of see it with like beginning from, like the Back to the Land movement of the 1960s, but like where that fell woefully short. You know, where it was very sort of, it was strictly like secessionist or something without any attempt, without any sort of like conflictuality or militancy, without any sort of like liberatory horizon involved, except for the people that were like fleeing to become farmers who have no idea what they're doing. And then, trying to like turn on tuning in and drop out.
Still people that believe that you can make yourself free just by, you know, going off with a bunch of your friends and maybe one of you has a trust fund and like buying a farm somewhere.
Yeah. Which is like not entirely different than the people who think you can make yourself free just by like squatting and eating out of dumpsters, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like neither of these like lifestyle approaches are significant. We need to build material power. We need to like reclaim power through control over life supporting infrastructure. And that's sort of what this book attempts to try to answer.
So moving right along, you know, in yet another valedictory section before we get to the steps that we're going to work together.
Gotta work the steps.
Gotta work those steps. It says, we have the power to make an irreversible break, which, and it goes on and on about how, you know, we have the power to do the revolution. And I'm like, fuck yeah. You know, this is a call to action. I think it's a cheerleady text in many ways. And like, on the one hand, I'm really jealous if they actually believe this, because, and like talking to some of these people, I kind of get the impression that they do. But like, on the other hand, it's also possible they're just trying to like, you know, it's propaganda. It's a call to arms. They're trying to cheerlead so that other people believe this too. And therefore it makes it more likely to actually be true.
I started rereading for the first time in like 6 years The Coming Insurrection a few days ago on a hike.
Yeah.
In the suburbs. And it says, like, I think it's in the preface to it that came out in 2009 or something, that, you know, revolutionary material powers like built not through contagion, but through resonance. And I think a lot of these sort of texts, and Habit included, communicates through resonance, where this like you, cheerleader is a great term for it, right? We have the power to make an irreversible break. It's supposed to stir something in the soul, and it doesn't stir something in everybody. And they only are interested in those that are stirred, right? Those who hear the call, those who follow the call, that is who they're trying to communicate with. And it's like, for me, it's like, I don't want to say we're at square one in building a material revolutionary force or communism in the United States, but we're pretty fucking close.
Yeah.
To say square one, I think invisibilizes like our ties, our relationships, our projects, our actually existing material flows. You know, even just to look back at the last few years, the friendships and the networks and the relationships that have been built through the Defend the Forest movement or something, like to say square one invisibilizes all of that. Like, and I don't want to conceive of that as pre-work, because that's probably a faulty, you know, understanding of history. But like, we are kind of at step one with this. And I think that's sort of that they're laying the groundwork, the sort of like emotionally stirring groundwork, to usher people into this step work, if you will. So it's like, we have the power to make an irreversible break. If you believe that, or if you want to believe that, come join us on this project. Keep reading.
I want to believe. We'll put that on a fucking poster. Instead of aliens, it's the Rev.
Fuck yeah.
So speaking of step one, I think what you say, there it is. I think what you say is very true, because step one is find each other. And I feel like that's what we have been working on all along. I feel like that's a lot of what we were trying to do on our Block Cop City speaking tour, during which we became friends for the first time, like 4 months ago.
That's wild.
Yeah. So, yeah, find each other. That is the first step that they are talking about. You wanna talk about it?
Yeah, you know, we've been raised in a culture of isolation and defeat, where our potential is reduced to meeting the economy's demands. We need to begin to eliminate isolation, to cut through the bullshit, to turn to to the closest to you and say that you need a life in common.
That's so crucial, and it's also so hard, right?
Yeah.
Because we live in a society that is inherently alienating and separates us from one another. I mean, this is something, community is something that's I've thought about so much, and it's so important to me. Even before I was really that political in any way, like I mean, now I'm going to give you my fucking sob story about my childhood that you may or may not know. But like, I was very, very, very alone until college, but really until after college. Like, I'm an only child. Both of my parents worked. I got picked on a lot. I didn't have a lot of friends at school. My mom like pulled me out of the one school and put me in another one and then another one. And, you know, I don't know if it's like neurodiversity, if it's just like kids randomly choosing me to pick on or what, or me not having any siblings to like toughen me up. Like, probably all the above. Anyway, I've spent my whole adult life trying to assemble a community for myself where I feel comfortable and other people feel welcomed as well. And I think it's maybe the thing I am the most proud of, that I have assembled such a cool group of friends. And really, I have a few now, but especially the core group of friends that I still consider my besties.
I mean, it sort of begins from the standpoint of like, from now on, all friendships are political, or something like that, where, you know, the infrastructure of our world manufactures isolated, atomized individuals. You know, it's like so much so that I don't even know if a society is the right term to describe what we have. You know, we've got all these individuals bopping around, not caring about one another. And there's not this element of the social in the way that there used to be or in the way that there could be. So it's like really beginning from, we need to find each other. We need to look around and we need to start breaking down these barriers of loneliness and isolation.
Word. But also, what if not all of your friends believe in communism? Like, I feel like the authors of this wouldn't think that that's a problem because they're trying to denude these things of politics. But like, some of my friends are not on board because guess what? I made most of these friends before I was a communist. So it's a real mixed bag.
Yeah, that's a really hard question for me to answer too, where it's like, for the last like 6 years or so, maybe 8 years, like I really haven't had any new friendships emerge in this world that weren't originally premised on like some shared perceptions or some shared political lens or framing. And I've like recently become very skeptical of that after spending time and making a few new friends through various like non-political activities that I've been doing of just people that I find utterly delightful, you know? And I don't have an answer to that question. I don't think that Inhabit makes a claim on that question. But like, for me, it's like, are your friendships serving in your quest, in a collective quest of becoming like, of becoming, you know, like, are these friendships serving each other in a way that like are generative and building capacity and building power towards whatever end your little crew might want, whether you call it communism or not, you know, just joy and meaning, the good life, right? If your friendships aren't contributing towards the good life, you probably should reevaluate your friendships.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, my concept of the good life is very wrapped up with my concept of communism at this point. And it is true, you know, I feel like the friends of mine who have gone on this political journey, not necessarily with me, but at least parallel to me, it's like we've discovered a whole new level to our friendship. And the ones that haven't, you know, sometimes we've drifted apart a little bit. And that's a thing that happens too. I will say, I think we should have more communities in the city. I'm a big city person. I'm a big city stan. I don't like the idea of people would have to, I mean, obviously real estate is fucking expensive, so there's like practical considerations, but like I feel like cities are more conducive to the kinds of networks, these kinds of tight networks of you know, social reproduction that we want to produce, rather than having everyone be spread out in the countryside trying to fight this this revolution.
Step one. Step two is establish hubs, which is sort of like, hubs are the point of aggregation, the centers of activity. Pool resources, target an area, and start a hub. Rent a space in the neighborhood, build a structure in the forest, take over an abandoned building or a vacant piece of land. No space is too small or too ambitious. Start with what's at hand and then multiply. Use the hub to ground all of your initiatives. So it's like, in the process of finding each other, you know, there's obviously this like idea of like a third space and a lack of third spaces that exist in this world. We just have work and we have home, and there's nowhere you can go that doesn't like require you to spend money to engage in some sort of social thing besides like libraries and parks. A hub is sort of like the social center or something like that, that can be used as a mechanism to find each other. One thing that I think this sort of leaves out in the establishing of hubs and running spaces together is, for me, it's like, I think we really need to work through running a space with people is extremely fucking difficult. There are like tensions, it puts strain on relationships, it puts strain on people's pocketbooks. So like really in establishing hubs, which I think is really important and is something that I would love to do again soon, really foregrounding healthy relationships, courageous conversations, accountability, and having some sort of like money making, some answer to the question of how are we going to pay for this that isn't just like a bunch of people scrounging to make rent every week.
Yeah, I mean, it's easier said than done to, quote, rent a space in your neighborhood when you live in, I don't know, New York City. Like, do you know how much rent is in New York City? It's not cheap. So that's, you know, that's definitely a hurdle. But I am really impressed at all the people who are actually doing it. Like, I know I gave a shout out to Woodbine Space on the last episode, but I'm going to do it again. I love my local hub. They have talks, they have dinners, and it's really a great place for serious revolutionaries to meet each other, talk about strategy, talk about analysis, watch films, hang out socially afterwards, and then, yeah, I think cool kinds of networks can grow informally out of that. Step 3, become resilient. Quote, learn to hunt, to code, to heal. Increase your collective strength. In preparation, now this is me talking, in preparation for the total collapse of society and hopefully the birth really, really fast of another one before everybody dies.
It's interesting because it's like this is, you know, I think a lot of the popular imaginary is encapsulated with and captured by this fantasy of apocalypse. You know, so many of the most popular pop fiction pieces and pop culture pieces and fiction movies and things like that are, you know, apocalyptic fantasies. It's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism or something. And inhabits not some semblance of a prepper disposition or something like that. That's probably not the right word because that's super loaded in terms of it's just like individualist element or something like that. But it's sort of saying, no, what does it look like to prepare for the end of the world, which we are already experiencing together collectively to cut through the isolation and to not be like, all we need is more guns. It's like, no, we need community. We need relationships. We need dense political ties. We need a pact to face the world together. And we need to like have skills to do this. You know, we need to learn how to cook for 100 people. We need to learn how to code. We need to like crack open. They talk a lot about cracking open technology. You know, it's not like a primitivist manifesto. It's not like turning its back on technology, but it's like, how do we come up with viruses to cause police drones to drop out of midair harmlessly by hacking them? Ooh. You know, that's
Ooh. Giving me goosebumps.
So step 3, become resilient.
Teach the communists to code.
Step 4, share a future. Create collective forms of care. Get organized with the next 20 years in mind. Ask each other how your needs will change as you age, have children, become disabled, begin to die. Address the most difficult questions. How to face madness, addiction, interpersonal violence, and traumatic loss. At all costs, protect each other from institutionalization.
It continues, and it talks a little bit about health specifically. It says, health collectives learn ancestral methods of birth control and abortion to ensure autonomous choice. And I don't know, this sounds kind of bad to me. Like, I'm not going to let some rando with a stick of fucking Palo Santo give me an abortion. Like, I want to go to a clinic. I want a real doctor.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sold on herbalism and stuff to be the only answer in the realm of medicine. I too like my doctors, but it's like, you know, I like my doctors because they are a person who is an expert in their field and I can come to them in confidence and in privacy with sensitive questions that I have. But I will say that like it does sort of feel like it strips me of all autonomy in naming my ailments and naming what I'm going through, and sort of takes away my power in the ability to heal myself, and sort of concentrates in that that ability in the hands of like a professionalized class. And I don't like that element of it. It's hard for me sometimes to imagine what community care, community health care would look like, because it is such an alienated, atomized, economized relationship to some like weird, sterile medical professional. And it's like, I've had no continuity of care, which is a term that I heard, which is like the idea of like seeing the same doctor for years and years or decades on end. And they have a really sort of intimate knowledge of you as a person and of your needs and of your body and of your medical history. It's like, I've moved like 10 times in the last 8 years. Like, I've not had a continuity of care. And I think I'm missing something in my like posture towards wellness as a result of that.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, let's continue. Okay, this starts to answer my question about how I want a real doctor, right? It says, partisan doctors, herbalists, and shamans make a pact to provide care for the network. Okay, first of all, I would like a doctor, please. But yeah, it's making this, it's painting a picture where they are real doctors, but they're partisans, so they're going to do like underground medical care of various kinds, but it's real, and they're going to do it in these autonomous health clinics that makes people less dependent on hospitals and the government. So this feels like a real dual power, one of you got a classic dual power scenario, right, where people start running shit, and this establishes a power of their own separate from the state. And then eventually when they have a revolution, you know, the people who are already running a bunch of shit, they run all the shit, which sounds really good. Sounds really good in theory. I do think it's being a little Pollyanna-ish about the number of people who would almost certainly fall through the cracks in this scenario, right? Like the idea that you could do mutual aid for chemotherapy, kidney dialysis, etc., etc. Like, this is going to be a chaotic period in history, and a lot of people are going to die probably who wouldn't have otherwise, right? I forget who it was now, but Sean had a great story that he told on the Intifada about some famous, you know, French communist crazy person that he met. I mean, I shouldn't call him a crazy person, that's ableist, but, you know, just a real galaxy brain French communist. But, like, I mean, he described this period, this chaotic period after the revolution, as 100 years of primitive surgery. And, you know, that sounds, I think the truth, best case scenario, probably lies in the middle.
Yeah, it's like, I think Inhabit's trying to answer this question. It's like, the world is becoming increasingly unstable. Like, look at how disrupted healthcare was from the pandemic, and how disruptive the supply chain collapse as a result of it was disruptive to like even procuring basic pieces of equipment for tech and for otherwise, which obviously had profound effects on the healthcare system. Not to mention the plague that was going around and the effects that that was having. But just like with disruptions in supply chains, these things that we've come to rely on, these institutions, aren't as, you know, steadfast as we might assume them to be and take them to for granted to be or something like that. So I think this, you know, dual power scenario, sort of like, how do we build up the capacity to do these things, to do some semblance of these things ourselves, so that when the inevitable, you know, degradation of the infrastructure that traverses our world, when the supply chain gets strained again, we have an answer to some of these questions that we traditionally relied on others to solve.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's also an argument to be made that, you know, it might be necessary to go through a temporary period of increased premature death and suffering in order to end the cycle forever Right, because that is also true of our current reality. What you were talking about with the deaths from COVID, I think a lot of that was arguably caused by capitalism. Like, oh, we can't, like the rational thing to do would be to just shut everything down, shut down the economy, stop making people go to work for, you know, as long as you have to. But it couldn't even do that, right? Also, like the amount of working together that countries didn't do because of capitalist competition and political concerns was huge. I mean, you had Western companies hoarding the vaccines that they wouldn't give to people in the developing world, things like that. So, like, you know, like the crisis is already happening, and we got to remember that, like, whenever people are like, oh, well, this sounds violent and scary. But the current reality is violent and scary for so many people.
What that brings to mind for me is just like kind of the contradictions that in this like rad lib politics of safety, where everything has to be couched in this like safety plan and this language of safety, and we can't take too much risk. We can't introduce risks. We can't. It's like dog, like, look at the insurrection of 2020. This was like, there was like the scariest global unfolding pandemic at the height of the fear. And people were like breaking isolation orders and like social distancing guidelines and rioting, fighting the police and engaging in arson. Like, none of that was safe, you know? But that was like the most powerful revolutionary force that has emerged in this country since the 60s. Since 1968, probably, or something like that. Maybe the most powerful anti-police force that's ever emerged from this country in terms of, like, materials and numbers. But it's like the world that we want is on the other side of risk.
Yeah. But, yeah, I do think it might gloss over the risks and the sacrifices a little bit. Because, again, this is a call. It's a work of propaganda. It's a call to arms. But, you know, maybe it doesn't have to do absolutely everything.
They don't mention guns in here.
I noticed that. Well, that brings me to our next step, step five, bring the fight. And it is sort of interesting that it doesn't mention arms, especially when we are in the U.S., which is the gun country, for better or for worse. I tend to think for worse.
Yeah, for worse. That's not wrong.
I tend to think any revolution in the U.S. would be extra terrifying for that reason. And yeah, it is, yeah. You know, like, why do things pop off so much harder in France? I think there's lots of different reasons for that. And France is a country where this tendency sort of originated, I think, if we're looking at communization currents. Like, there are lots of reasons for that, but one reason is that the police have guns here, and they will shoot you if you get out of line. So, yeah, interesting that they sidestep this issue, but they're, you know, I guess I understand why. Maybe it's just a can of worms that they don't want to open up right now, but basically this part, yeah?
I have a lot of sympathy for the sidestepping of the issue of firearms. It's like, I don't want my social movement spaces or my street confrontations or my revolutionary theory and outreach and optics to be premised on one of gun ownership and gun use. Like,
no.
There's this like in a moment of rupture, what needs to happen is generalization of like ungovernable gestures and acts that can spread throughout a population that anyone can take up. And that's sort of why, like, the one of the reasons why the Yellow Vest movement, which isn't morally pure or something like that, but was a huge revolutionary movement in France, all it took to be a legitimate actor in that was to wear a yellow reflective vest. And poof, now you're a part of this revolutionary movement, right? The second that guns are brought into the picture, and in order to be a powerful or legitimate actor, you need a firearm, we're going to lose immediately. Like the right, we don't even need to say this, like, the right is so much more heavily armed than the left and always will be in the United States. And we want to bring people in. And having this, like, hyper-specialized, hyper-scary, hyper-violent, hyper-dangerous, like, gun in the fucking situation is not going to build our movements. And that being said, guns are a lived reality in this country. They're not going anywhere, clearly. Therefore, those who feel like they should, like, can skill themselves up on knowing how to use these machines, these, I don't want to say tools because that's what the fucking right calls them, but these, like, tools or whatever, because they do exist. And that's part of the material conditions that we live in. And I guess lastly is, like, what's more important than training on guns is training on how to respond to a gunshot wound. Before you get, like, equipped in sharpshooting, you should learn how to treat a gunshot wound, and only then begin your process of learning how to use these very dangerous objects.
Yeah.
Done ranting.
For
Sorry.
Sure. No, I totally agree with that. I liked the chapter in the George Floyd book that I keep referencing by the Vortex Group, where it deals sort of very practically with this question and, you know, whether or not the presence of guns in a lot of these different cities in 2020, whether they helped or hurt this kind of collective progress towards a left-wing insurrection, although, you know, the guy who wrote that would never use that kind of language. But that's basically what I took from it. Did the presence of guns in these crowds make people feel more included and empowered, or did it turn a lot of people off? Like, in the chapter about Atlanta, the Wendy's autonomous zone, you know, a lot of folks in the neighborhood, including, like, older Black folks, they associated guns with, like, gangs and young knuckleheads running around. So when people were, like, you know, patrolling the entrance of this place with guns, they were like, yeah, this maybe we're going to peace out on this situation. So that's just one of many examples. But let's sidebar that for now, because the text also sidebars it, and that's fine. You know, it's just a zine, guys. It's not a whole book. It's just a little, it's a small bean.
A little baby.
So maybe it's a little baby. So maybe the next one we'll talk about guns in more detail. But what they do talk about is all the other ways that we need to be gearing up, getting ready for an insurrection that's going to require a real combination of physical strength and technical know-how, right? And it even has a link. I love this. It has a link to a strength and conditioning guide for insurgents. So basically, if you want to get swole, if you want to be the swoletariat, go to your local Antifa gym and start a fight club. It literally says to that there's going to be a network of fight clubs.
Inhabit.body.
Oh my god, I missed that part. That's come to our new network of gyms, Inhabit.body, and you know, it's like I always say, a fascist worked out today. Did you?
You know, it's like if you go back to the Inhabit website, the first thing on the homepage is we're building a platform for revolutionary autonomy. So I sort of see that Inhabit.body is part of that platform.
Sure, sure. And all of our bodies will soon be part of it as well. I mean, this is like pretty spicy stuff. Like, how do we feel about this? Oh, because, you know, there's people who want to pretend like the Antifa super soldier thing isn't real, but no, like, they're like, no, it's real and it's good and you should be one too.
It says, yeah, it says, become stronger, make yourself capable of force. And I really like that. And the reason I like it is because it's such a strong deviation from a sort of tendency that I see in leftist politics, which is like an aversion to power, an aversion to the language of power building. It's interested in, like, you know, and you look at a lot of these like politics of safety, anti-power building, political tendencies that first and foremost began on like shame and weakness and vulnerability. And you can't help but see them as their impotence. You know, and it's like if we're actually interested in building a material revolutionary force, the question of building our power, of following the line along which our collective power grows together towards that liberatory horizon, is the base bone of what we need to be talking about. Real hot take here, but the government and the police and the military are a lot more powerful than us right now, right? And we need to build our collective power to overcome these obstacles, and there's no way around that. So when they say become, you know, make yourself capable of force, I think that's what they're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, open question as to whether, I mean, we'll get into this at the end, but whether that's actually going to be enough. But I certainly like the idea of becoming powerful, and maybe there's an element of personal responsibility there, which they talked about at the Ending Our Addiction to Losing panel that we both liked so much. I think that's going to be out soon in our feed, actually. We captured some audio. We just got to, like, get, you know, make super sure that we have everyone's permission before we post it, right? But yeah, maybe we could take this concept back from the right a little bit and be like, yeah, we all have a personal responsibility to free ourselves and each other in whatever way we are capable of doing, and maybe it's okay to, like, push ourselves a little where that stuff is concerned.
Yeah. So, yeah. We're like, we can no longer be concerned just with saying the right words and being as moral as possible. Like, we live in a world premised on power, and the future is shaped by those with the most power to shape it. And if we want to be able to shape the future, we need to build enough power to be able to do that. And any serious revolutionary force in the history of the human story has known that and has followed that sensibility. Hey, mm-hmm. friends. Sam here in post-production. Jamie and I had to record this episode separate occasions, as Jamie was getting over being sick and I was dealing with some life stuff.
So dinner is at 8.
In the flow of the conversation.
We're like so close to being done. Enjoy. But I feel like I have to go. Step 6, expand the network. Quote, "We don't need another organization to bring us together to talk about problems, but ways to implement concrete practices to solve them. We need a network that amplifies the power of each project, widens the territory, and refuses to leave the future up to chance." End quote. So, and then it has a nice little envisioning that I won't read because we're running out of time, of how these different groups of people working on different projects can kind of come together to do exactly what this paragraph says. So whether this distinction between network, which is good in their eyes, and organization, which is bad, like, what's wrong with organizations? This is a leading question.
I think it really depends on who you ask. I don't think everyone would agree that organizations are bad. And I don't know if I would say it that simplistically. In my head, organizations that I've been a part of in the past have focused so much on talking about what they do that they kind of back themselves into a single channel of action. They seem sometimes to be like somewhat inflexible because they've got this such a sort of like outside conception of what they are. And it exists not necessarily towards the end that they set out for themselves at the beginning, like in their mission statement. But sometimes I see organizations, maybe capital O organizations especially, end up existing just to reproduce themselves. And they lose sight of their mission because they're so focused on maintaining a level of organizational continuity. I think also sometimes like an organization is something that sometimes you have to like either be a member of or like be in or not be in, you know, and there's like, it's a little bit binary sometimes in terms of one's involvement with it, where you're either like a partner or you're in the organization. And that can cause like, you know, you'll never find like an organization that like everybody that you want to build with wants to join or something like that. And sometimes it's a needlessly clunky framing, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I get that. I think that's why I like to say organizational forms when I'm talking about these new experiments we're doing, even if it is sort of kind of just another organization. But it's better. It's a better kind. And I think they should be judged based on what they're doing, obviously. Like, is it an organization for the sake of having an organization? Or is it a grouping of people that is nimble enough to change based on conditions on the ground that's engaged in active efforts of doing things? So it also reminds me of the strategy of composition a little bit. The part that I did not read describes different groups of people who are, you know, perhaps so different that they might not necessarily join each other's organizations. Working together is sort of an assemblage, you know, more of a stew than a melting pot. There's no need for homogeneity, especially talking in the U.S. context. We're such a large and diverse country that that seems to be a more realistic strategy.
I liked that allegory, simile. I'm not sure. I like the vision of the soup. I think I'm just hungry, but
one you thing love soup.
I do be soupin'. You know, one thing that sort of I've been trying to think about a lot over the last few months is like, what does it mean to form to develop a revolutionary organizational form in which all of the like participants in it can sort of show up as their full selves, and what makes them the most unique and offer and bringing the most sort of like important element of their lives and their politics and their ethics and their beliefs and their skills to the table, and not have to like lower down to this lowest common denominator coalition style organizing where everybody has to put aside their differences and just work on this one thing. But what does it mean to like actually lean into and uplift our different forms of life, different beliefs, different ways of doing things in a way that works symbiotically with one another? And in my head, sometimes these like dusty forms like an organization or an NGO or like whatever the fuck you want to call it, something that's a little more rigid, it's harder to imagine it being conducive to all these different types of folks showing up to like a mosaic of difference, like working together on a project. And I think like this conception of like a network or like a web of ties is easier for me to imagine that.
Yeah, love a web. Shall we move on to step seven?
Step seven
is build autonomy. Quote, "We're dependent on the capitalist system, which forces us to either submit or starve. There's no way around this fact. The material organization of the present world is the problem we must overcome." And then there's a little fiction paragraph. Shall we read it?
Sure. A local food distribution hub opens a cooperative grocery on the other side of town. Needing to expand capacity, the nearby farm that grows their vegetables integrates into a bioregional network looking to share a world as well as fresh food. A group of designers and engineers who hate their jobs team up to create an app that coordinates a flexible supply chain among the farms and distribution points. These efforts lead to an autonomous trade corridor springing up. The growth of the network's force and the utter disregard for regulations leaves the authorities helpless, as food and people circulate freely along with the spirit of rebellion.
Ooh. No health department in this communist future.
Hell yeah.
We're just all going to have to trust each other to not give us diarrhea.
I don't know if I necessarily trust the health department, though.
I mean, look, I've thought a lot about this. Maybe, okay, am I doxing myself if I say that my dad worked for the Connecticut Health Department for the majority of his life? Maybe it's that I'm the daughter of a, you know, civil servant. Maybe it's that I worked at the Majority Report, where my boss was the voice of Hugo the health inspector on Bob's Burgers. But Yeah, you gotta have a health department. And like a lot of the reason why, like, look, okay, on the one hand, it's true. A lot of the corners that get cut are because of capitalism, right? A lot of the babies that get poisoned with the, you know, with the bad formula or whatever, it's because they wanted to save money and they cut corners. And if the profit motive is not involved, those problems would obviously not be there. Those particular ones anyway. But, you know, there's also like a lot of motherfuckers who just don't know what they're doing. So.
I will say, like, if you've ever been to like a protest encampment kitchen or something like that, the people who run that shit are not fucking around when it comes to like best practices. In all of my experiences, and yes, for our listeners, I'm sure that there's some horrid example of which people have deviated from best practices and everybody gets like fucking E. coli or something. But that happens everywhere, you know, like in formal capitalist world or something. I'm just imagining like back when the FDA, the George H.W. Bush FDA, you know, had their lovely revolving door of Monsanto employees that like went back and forth between the, you know, the Food Administration and these big biotech companies, and then just green lighted all Roundup Ready and all these GMO products that, like, you know, may or may not cause sterility in the third generation. Guess we'll find out.
Yeah. No, I think the problem with the health department is mostly problems of capitalism. Mm-hmm. But, and it's not the fact that food is regulated or whatever, but you know, obviously the one we have now is capitalist and fascist and bad, so like really who cares what they think about anything. But generally I like the idea of building autonomy, of course, and it is true the people in charge of bottom lining the food at these encampments that we've both been a part of, you know, I would say the quality of the food varies in terms of how tasty it is.
Hope but you like lentils.
Look, I love lentils, but there is you got to put some seasoning in there. That's all I'm going to say. But like, yeah, I have yet to get sick from any of it, and I have a very sensitive tummy. So, you know, maybe anarchists with fucking Sterno stoves or whatever they use, they can run the world. And build autonomy.
I like this question.
See a key word.
They do say under build autonomy, step 7, answer questions of collective material power. How to feed each other, house each other, heal each other, leverage data and design without falling into the trap that the internet will save us. Develop scalable solutions to the problems of energy, distribution, communication, and logistics. So these things are like very like this. None of that is a step to do any of that, right? Like develop scalable solutions to the problems of energy, right? Like Inhabit doesn't pretend to tell you how to do that, but it's sort of like a framework for what would it actually mean to build autonomy at scale. Well, we have to answer these questions of healthcare. We have to answer these questions of shelter, of energy, of things like that. And it's only through like technical knowledge of something that we can participate in developing an energy grid or a mesh network or autonomous healthcare enterprises and things like that. You know, it's like a lot of these are technical questions that really can only be answered by people who are specialists in whatever field it is. So it's not a matter of turning our back on these things. It's a matter of linking and building with these specialists and developing and cultivating and sharing and making reproducible skills and approaches to this work.
Yeah. I'd say the Inhabit model relies on a lot of people who are technically trained and who have been technically trained under the current paradigm to kind of switch. I don't even want to say switch sides, because a lot of people in the world right now aren't necessarily on the side of the party of order, or it's just like, you know, they're people who exist in the world. But it would require a lot of people with this kind of training to actively defect and, you know, take real risks, risk their medical licenses, operating underground clinics, doing illegal abortions, things of that nature in order for it to succeed. which, cool. Yeah, that's a great goal to have. I also want to know, like, how people are going to get technical training in the future if we abolish institutions. But perhaps that's a question for another zine.
Indeed. Well, that plays nicely, I think, into step eight, which you were just asking, which is destitute infrastructure.
Oh, destitute. Is that being used as a verb here? What does that mean?
So I think, and I am not a, despite my bachelor's degree, I'm not a philosopher and I'm not a scholar, although I am a gentleman. But I think destitute comes from Agamben originally. And we can think of like it as a juxtaposition to constitute. So like the other versions of the word are like constituent and destituent. Destitute, constitute, destitution, or constitution, like the constitution. And sort of so we think back to like when there's a revolution, how does that happen? There's a revolution, the government's overthrown through insurrection or whatever, and then all the people get together and they have a constitutional assembly where they figure out what the next constitution is going to be, and they, the constituents, constitute a new government. And then it's like, it's just this sort of, that's just what the, you know, the Western revolutionary framing has been for a very long time. Well, what would it mean instead of constituting? So to destitute, to empty out, to make superfluous, to make unnecessary, to render useless these pieces of infrastructure, or the government or the police, by coming up with, you know, by doing steps 1 through 7 and ultimately having some semblance of autonomy to make this infrastructure superfluous. And like the reason I think they focus on infrastructure, you know, I don't think it's a secret that like Inhabit is informed somewhat by like the texts of the Invisible Committee, for example, sort of stemming from that lineage. And, you know, the Invisible Committee really puts forward, they say that power is infrastructural. And it's not, they're not the first people to say that, but that's like that's a core tenet of that political theory, that power is infrastructural. It's not in these empty, tasteless institutions that nobody fucking has any faith in anymore. It's in control over the internet. It's in control over the power grid. It's in control over the highways and the water. And like power has moved into that realm. So in order to actually take agency and take power in this world, we have to destitute, make superfluous, hollow out, and make useless the institutional control over infrastructure by establishing our own, or taking, and what they say, hack everything. So it's not necessarily an abandonment of pre-existing infrastructure, but it's a how do we take it from concentrated control and crack it open and spread it around for everyone.
Yeah, it seems like, okay, I'm not an expert on this either, but it seems like you can trace a line from the sort of German-Dutch council communism model to this, if you think about, the work of governing, running society is not going to be done by elected officials in a government building. It's going to be done by these councils of workers who are actually doing the things that keep everybody alive in the process of doing it. So that makes sense. I think this part, this chapter, this step, there's parts of it that make sense to me, and there's parts of it that don't make sense to me as someone who is not a complete anarchist, at least not yet. Like, it talks about the infrastructure of the world, the current infrastructure, and how some of it needs to be destroyed. For example, fossil fuels, right? We need to get rid of that, and how some of it can be repurposed. Like, an example that I will come up with is trains, right? Communists love trains. We should have more of them. And, you know, it should be fucking free and, you know, maybe they'll even run on time. You know, fascists don't have a monopoly on that. So that makes a lot of sense, right? But then it says seize power without governing. And it just seems like, why? Like, making decisions, running a large and complex world. Like, that's governance, certainly, unless you're fucking Ann Prim. And, you know, if you're council communist, you just think that work should be done by the people who are doing the work, but it doesn't make it unnecessary. And even very anarchistic models of living, like I'm thinking about the Zapatistas, for instance, they have these juntas de buen gobierno, these councils of good governance, and they're very, they rotate people out very frequently, and they make decisions in consultation with everyone who shows up to these town meetings or whatever. But like, I don't know how we run such a large and complicated world without any version of that.
I don't think that Inhabit is vying for a world in which no decisions are ever being made, or like large projects aren't being spearheaded. I think that they actually command, like, the vision of freedom and agency offered in Inhabit requires this large scale projects, and large scale like collaborations. You know, how do we keep the trains running? How do we feed millions of people without having large scale projects, collective decision making structures? Now, Inhabit doesn't concern themselves with the specifics of like what these intercommunalism council of good governance projects systems might look like, but I don't think that they imply that it's not required. So when they say seize power without governing, I think that goes back to this idea that power actually doesn't lie in the governmental institutions. Power lies in who controls the infrastructure of the world, you know? And like in America, like that's not the fucking government, you know? That's Facebook, that's Apple, that's Google, that's, you know, whoever fucking controls the Keystone XL pipeline, and all of these like large scale infra, and some of it's the government, sure, interstates, things like that, utility grids, Chicago water, whatever. But the power itself doesn't lie in these sort of antiquated political institutions. It lies in simply having control over that infrastructure.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm also thinking of the question, like, how do you seize power while maintaining a non-state form of governing, right? Like, how do you create a system that is strong enough to win the revolution and to fight off all, you know, counter-revolutionary forces, but does not in and of itself become this sort of wartime bureaucracy that sets the precedent for what it is going forward. I mean, it's been a live question throughout the history of communist thought. The idea of an emergency dictatorship, right, that was one taken up by Marx and Lenin in the form of the dictatorship of the proletariat, right? It's this temporary emergency, you know, because we're at war. So we need to arrange things a little differently than they're going to be able to happen under full communism. But anyway, I think, you know, no one's really come up with a satisfying answer to this question. And I have more thoughts on that, but I'll save them for my wrap up, which we'll get to pretty soon.
Cool. Yeah. And I don't think that we have the answers to that either. Inhabit doesn't have the answers to that either. But I think that's where this notion of destitution comes in. So like in juxtaposition to constitution, we have a destitution. I don't know what that is.
Sure.
We should figure out what that means instead of just playing with words. But
maybe someday we'll have destitutional scholars.
I've been trying to get my homie to write the destitutional the destituent power reader for a long time, and he had to do something more important and have a fucking kid instead of do that. So here we are.
Boo.
Boo. Okay. Step 9. become ungovernable. Revolution is a line we trace in the present. It means building autonomy here and now, making government and economy superfluous. There's my word. Breaking out of being governed will mean more than winning battle after battle and outmaneuvering political foes. It will rest on our ability to create the lasting foundation for a life in common. And this, I think, is the most, one of the most important elements of this entire school of thought. Spread secession to all areas of life. Go on permanent strike, slowly but surely, and take everyone with you. Refuse to be managed or manage anyone in turn. Drive a wedge down the center of society. Disavow a lifetime's worth of cynicism and resentment, and believe that it is all possible.
Sounds good.
Sounds good. Yeah, I just like this idea of secession. And I think like it's hard, like that word for me is like a little triggering because it brings up images of like the fucking Confederacy or something, the secessionists.
Yeah.
But they don't get a monopoly. Like a lot of our fucking battles are fought over the meanings of words and the ideas that they represent. And like we can't, you know, let our enemies take all of these words, right? Like if you Google the word insurrection, I think you can imagine what comes up, but it's the fucking January 6th fuckers, you know? Yeah. And it's like, you know, we anarchists have been working on that for hundreds of fucking years. And now you Google it and it's these right wing chuds, these racist fucks.
Well, they also stole the word anarchist from us after stealing the word libertarian. So, you know, language follows power. If we want our words back, we're going to have to take some power.
So spreading secession to all areas of life. There's these, oh, I wish I had one with me. These inhabit bumper stickers that say co-exit. So it's like instead of coexist, you know, it's co-exit.
I like
so
that.
Exit the world together. And I think that really encapsulates sort of beautifully what this entire text represents. Is like, what would it mean to abandon this clusterfuck of reality and secede from whatever the fuck this is into a new way of relating to each other, into a new way of building collective power. They use this language of territorialization or territories. And I think that's a really important contemporary revolutionary framework. One version of it expressed is like a sort of territorial struggle to defend the Atlanta forest and one of the, or a territorial struggle to stop the Keystone, the fucking Dakota Access Pipeline. And a lot of times the reason why some of these struggles become such hotbed issues, and you could compare this to like fighting against NATO or the World Trade Organization or something, these abstract globalist fucking entities.
Globalist.
You sounded just like him. Versus these like territorial struggles that are like earthbound and place-based and have real tangible, you know, they require localized infrastructure and like a staking your claim on the future of a sector of space.
Yeah, so the territories, I wanted to talk about that, and then let's give our final thoughts, because I think, you know, it's just a scene, it's not that detailed, but basically their vision for communizing the world is very territory-based, and I'll quote, they say, "Our goal is to establish autonomous territories, expanding ungovernable zones that run from sea to shining sea. Fault lines crossing North America, leading us to Providence and, you know, presumably the world because it's global communism, right? These autonomous territories will open to new flows for travel and resources, waypoints during ecological crisis, and the ground to reclaim techniques and technologies of which we've been dispossessed." So I think that describes it pretty well. It also, I'm going to reference that Ill Will piece that seems to come out of the same tendency, that is about the territorial struggle over the Atlanta forest, where they're like, dude, what if instead of just defending the forest, we defended like everywhere? And I put it in my notes, galaxy brain intensifies, because it's like, we can't even defend the fucking forest, guys. Or, I mean, we're trying, but there's like no sure indicator that we're going to succeed. So that feels like, you know, jumping a few steps ahead. But then again, you know, it's a vision and it's propaganda. So
we should,
maybe it's okay to think like that.
That would be an appropriate zine to read for an upcoming reading group session. Before I forget,
the
States of Siege.
Sure.
But before I forget, one more word on territories. Inhabit actually has a newsletter. So they don't, Inhabit is a text, but it's also like a sort of digital platform. What do they call themselves?
And
again?
It's a strategy.
Yeah.
Don't forget.
It's an anonymously and collectively authored strategy. Well, one of the strategies, digital assets, is their newsletter. And you can find that at territories.substack.com. And the newsletter is called Inhabit Territories. Over 5,000 subscribers for that newsletter. So
wow.
I guess listeners, make it 5,001 if you would like.
Cool.
So, Jamie, we just read Inhabit Instructions for Autonomy, which was collectively authored. It came out in 2018. Curious if it still stands up. What do you think about it, Jay?
That makes a lot of sense. I've been going around telling people that this is the new issue of Inhabit, and they're like, what? There's a new issue of Inhabit? No. I was like, yeah, they're just giving it out in Tucson. They'll love it. But okay, it's an old issue of Inhabit, whatever. Does it stand up now that I know that? I'll proceed this with a to be fair paragraph, okay? Because, I'm not fully convinced of Inhabit's vision for how we get global communism. But, you know, to be fair, I'm not convinced of anybody's vision yet.
Mm.
About how we do it, right? Like, I read a lot of Marx, and I read a lot of Marx, folks. I read a lot of Lenin for my old podcast, Everybody Loves Communism, right? And that's sort of communism classic, unfortunately. That's still like the thing that people are most likely to gravitate towards when they get into communism. I'm not saying unfortunately.
I don't think like, that's true.
No? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, never mind. But my point is, you know, right, we read Lenin's The State and Revolution. We read Marx's Critique of the Gotha Program. And, you know, those kind of describe their visions for how we're supposed to get to, quote unquote, higher stage communism via this first step of lower stage communism, otherwise known as state socialism, otherwise known as, you know, dictatorship of the proletariat, whatever, whatever. And, you know, they have these kind of beautiful visions for how the state's going to wither away once we have achieved these necessary preconditions for communism, right? And then it's going to be replaced by what Lenin calls the administration of things, this sort of basic, bare administrative state or bureaucracy that is not backed by violence. So it's not a proper state, but just, you know, make sure that shit's getting done. And,
not
you know,
backed by violence. So how did that one work out for Lenin's USSR?
Well, obviously, they didn't get to that stage. Mm. And, you know, I don't know that they even got to lower stage communism, per se. I don't know if they... there's definitely people who said that they did, but opinions differ on that, right? But my point is, like, no one's put forth a fully satisfying answer. And that one in particular has been sort of shown to be flawed by the history of the 20th century, right? So I really want to believe this communizer vision, this Inhabit vision, because I've kind of arrived at it at its doorstep, because I haven't, you know, fully walked through that door yet. But I've arrived at it through the process of elimination, right? So I want to believe it. And it has some things in common with the old ideas, right? Because it's essentially a dual power proposal with this modification that whatever we're going to have is not going to meet any criteria of being a state, right? It's going to seize power without governing. And, you know, some of these routes to doing that feel a little vibes based as to how we're going to keep everyone alive. I really do like Lenin's vision of the administration of things, this nonviolent sort of bureaucratic network, not There are people who think it could be run by an AI. I do not think we should let AI do this for us.
Who are you associating with?
I think it should be human beings. I don't know. Blind items.
And I should be, you know, sorry, listeners. I've never read Lenin, and I really haven't read Marx, and no, I never will.
You gotta at least listen to my episodes about it.
But I'll do that for you, not for Marx.
We had Jasper Burns on to talk about Critique of the Gotha Program. It was great.
Well, I think he's a very nice fellow. So one of the things that I like about Inhabit is that it doesn't require or command a certain political framing to carry this forth. It doesn't require that you identify as an anarchist and uphold these moralistic abstract principles of this and that and this and that and this horizontality or blah, 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 blah.
It feels pretty anarchist to me.
It's certainly anarchist, but it doesn't require that you think of yourself that way. It's concerned with questions of power. It's concerned with questions of communal agency over the conditions for the reproduction of life. It's a material question. It's not an ideological question. It's a question. And of course, like, ideologies and abstractions and theories underpin fucking everything that we do in our political work. And Inhabit is no exception to it. But I don't see it as a fetishization of a specific tendency or a specific ideology. I see it as like a framework, you know, a set of instructions for building autonomy that can maintain the sort of uniqueness of worlds, that can maintain a multiplicity of worlds. And I view that as opposed to something that's sort of that's a revolutionary program that requires you to do fucking anything, you know, that requires you to do anything, that requires, you know, in an attempt to make one world that's administered by the allegedly nonviolent, higher, you know, righteous administrative thing, you know, that requires participation in this, whatever. And I think Inhabit sort of begins from the failures of that sort of rigid radicalism. Yes, Lenin, I just called you a rigid radical. Shout out Joyful Militancy. But
shots fired.
Homie's dead.
You're lucky he's dead and he can't write a scathing response to you.
Oh my God. Imagine getting in a Twitter argument with Lenin.
Oh, no, that sounds terrible. Who's the modern day version of Lenin, though? Maybe you'll hear from Jorge.
It's like all of the fucking tankies are completely irrelevant in mainstream political politics. Like, literally, like, I just, like, if you listen to political discourse on fucking Twitter, all these people just sound ridiculous. I don't know.
I agree. These are some live ask questions, though, I think. Yeah. And it both makes me feel better and worse that, like, fucking Lenin and Rosa could not come to any kind of consensus on these things before they both died. I'm like, oh fuck, but we're gonna have to, though, because our lifetimes might be when the shit goes down. I'm like, oh, I'm not as smart as Rosa.
And I don't think we have to come to a consensus on anything, because I don't think it's possible to come to a consensus on anything. Like, I think Inhabit begins in this era of hyper-fragmentation in the world and says, how do we build power materially across these fragmented contexts that might not view themselves as being interconnected with other people, and have different ways of conceptualizing their life, have different forms of life? How do we build power across different forms of life, across worlds? And I think Inhabit has a pretty good contribution to that question that says, you know, to review the steps again, you know, it's find each other, establish hubs, become resilient, share a future, bring the fight, expand the network, build autonomy, destitute infrastructure, and become ungovernable. Is it perfect? No. Is any of that shit like particularly controversial? I don't think so.
No, they're all like good ideas, and I don't think even like I'm not gonna keep throwing around the T slur. I'm gonna call them Marxist Leninists. Not every Marxist-Leninist is a goddamn tanky.
No.
We are a multi-tendency podcast. We respect everybody within reason. But like, I think a lot of Marxist-Leninists would say the same things. They just want them to be used for slightly different, well, similar ends, at least the ones that are, you know, operating in good faith, but like different steps in between this and in between here and there, in between the things, the steps we all agree are good, these dual power arrangements, right? And, you know, step three, communism, the step in the middle, it's like, you know, the classic underpants gnomes problem. But I see what you're saying. So one more thought about this model, this very seductive and exciting model that they have set forth. Although I'm like pretty seduced and excited anytime anyone says any vision of communism, to be fair, lay my prejudices on the table. But I will say, I think this zine assumes to a large degree that state power is collapsing in on itself. Right. And that the government, these world governments are sort of increasingly crumbling. Right. And it kind of elides the scenario, which we can see at the present. Right. Where this, yes, things are falling apart, but we have an increasingly fascist government, because that's what happens when capitalism starts to, you know, set itself on fire. Right. You get fascism. We have these increasingly fascist governments applying massive military and carceral force to maintaining power and maintaining order, right? And I think perhaps Inhabit underestimates how hard it's going to be to stand up to that application of power and overthrow it, right? Especially in this age of, you know, high-tech surveillance and, you know, military technology. I mean, just look at what we see around us, right? Like, perceptions of government legitimacy are falling. A lot of people are pretty checked out of politics. Half of Americans don't vote, although turnout was up pretty high in 2020. But like, still, the idea that it's possible to overthrow this order in favor of something better is not something a lot of people buy into. And I might argue is less widespread than it was 100 years ago. So what do we do with that?
I think that that's sort of where Inhabit begins, is it's like this idea of, oh, what's the term? Like incongruent warfare or something like that. There's another term for it. But instead of trying to attack the state head on, what would it look like to build a revolutionary force in pockets where densities lie? And when I say densities, I mean close relationships of trust and a commitment to face the world together for the rest of our lives. And I think it's sort of, it's an answer to the revolutionary question that does that abandons this idea that we need to build up any type of force to overthrow the government head on. Because anyone with a fucking brain will say that we are eternally outgunned, probably forever, you know, probably forever. The right wing has, I don't know, I'm going to make this number up, 50 times more guns than the left wing, at least. And then when push ultimately comes to fucking shove, who are the police and the military going to side with, the right or the left? Like, come on, people. So I think it's like, you know, I think back to this, like, one of the opening controversial lines of that controversial zine, Desert, which says there will be no anarchist revolution. There will be no global uprising that overthrows all governments, you know. And I believe that. I don't think that, like, my theory of revolution doesn't require a giant force that overthrows the army and the police and Google in a head-on symmetrical way. The word I was looking for is asymmetrical warfare. So what would it look like to begin with the strengths that we do have, to begin with what we do have, and try to build out, You know, they say revolution is a line we trace here in the present to carve out spaces of freedom in the here and now, to develop shared communist practices in the here and now, not waiting for some hypothetical future that will probably never come. But to carve out these spaces of freedom in the here and now, and to connect them, sometimes above ground and oftentimes below ground, into a sort of a rhizomatic network, into a web of communes and forces and worlds that can maintain their uniqueness while developing a durable multi-generational pact and commitment to establish the infrastructure, the autonomy that they need to sustain their life and to live the good life. I think Inhabit is an attempt to try to answer this question: how do we live the good life in the here and now in a way that builds up power for a material revolutionary force, not to overthrow the government head on, but to do our own thing?
Doing your own thing is revolution. You heard it here first, folks. Oh, wow. We went long, but that's okay. You know, we had a lot of thoughts over the course of two different recording sessions, and we got them out there. So,
yeah.
Thanks for listening. This has been our first ever episode of this fucking Party Girls reading group that's mostly going to do zines. So... Are you ready? Are you ready to wrap it up?
I'm ready to wrap it up. You know, I think in the future, Jamie and I are going to think about what form makes the most sense for this reading group. And that can be a dynamic and flexible question week by week or over time. What level of collaboration is interesting to our listeners and to folks in our political spheres? That, like, do folks want to collaborate on a shared streamed or participatory reading group? I sure think that sounds fun. So folks have ideas on how to do that in a way that's generative and engaging and enjoyable. Hit us up.